Mark Twain Speaks. Kindly listen as Mark Twain performer Don McNeil brings the wit and wisdom of America's favorite humorist to life. Everyone is welcome, and cigar smoking is encouraged.
The approach of Mother's Day compels me to talk about my mother, Jane. What becomes of the multitudinous photographs which one's mind takes of people? Out of the million which my mental camera must have taken of this first and closest friend, only one clear and strongly defined one of later date remains. It dates back 47 years. She was 40 years old then, and I was 8. She held me by the hand, and we were kneeling by the bedside of my brother, 2 years older than I, who lay dead. And the tears were flowing down her cheeks, unchecked, as she was moaning. That dumb sign of anguish was perhaps new to me, since it made upon me a very strong impression, an impression which holds its place still with the picture which it helped to intensify and make memorable. She had a slender, small body, but a great heart, a heart so large that everybody's grief and everybody's joys found welcome in it and hospitable accommodation. The greatest difference which I find between her and the rest of the people whom I have known is this, and it is a remarkable one. Those others felt a strong interest in a few things, whereas to the very day of her death, my mother felt a strong interest in the whole world and everything and everybody in it. In her life, she knew such a thing as a half-hearted interest in affairs and people, or an entrance which drew a line and left out certain affairs and was indifferent to certain people. The invalid who takes a strenuous and indestructible interest in everything and everybody but himself, and to whom a dull moment is an unknown thing and an impossibility, is a formidable adversary for disease and a hard invalid to vanquish. I am certain that it was this feature of my mother's makeup that carried her so far toward her 90th year. Her interest in people and other animals was warm, personal, friendly. She always found something to excuse, and as a rule to love, in the toughest of them, even if she had to put it there herself. She was the natural ally and friend of the friendless. It was believed that, Presbyterian as she was, she could be beguiled into saying a soft word for the devil himself. And so the experiment was tried. The abuse of Satan began. One conspirator after another added his bitter word, his malign reproach, his pitiless censure, till at last, sure enough, the unsuspecting subject of the trick walked into the trap. She admitted that the indictment was sound, that Satan was utterly wicked and abandoned, just as these people had said. But would any claim that he had been treated fairly? A sinner was but a sinner. Satan was just that, like the rest. Who saves the rest? Their own efforts alone? No, or none might ever be saved. To their feeble efforts is added the mighty help of pathetic, appealing, imploring prayers that go up daily out of the churches in Christendom and out of myriads upon myriads of pitying hearts. But who prays for Satan? Who in 18 centuries has had the common humanity to pray for the one sinner that needed it most, our one fellow and brother who most needed a friend, yet had not a single one? The one sinner among us all who had the highest and clearest right to every Christian's daily and nightly prayers, for the plain and unassailable reason that this was the first and greatest need, his being among sinners the supremest. This friend of Satan was a most gentle spirit, and an unstudied and unconscious pathos was her native speak. When her pity or her indignation was stirred by hurt or shame inflicted on some defenseless person or creature, my mother was the most eloquent person I have heard speak. It was seldom eloquent of a fiery or violent sort, but gentle, pitying, persuasive, appealing, and so genuine and nobly worded and so touchingly uttered that many times I have seen it win the reluctant and splendid applause of tears whenever anybody or any creature was being oppressed. The fears that belonged to her sex and her small stature retired to the rear, and her soldierly qualities came promptly to the front. One day in our village, I saw a vicious man, a common terror in our town, chasing his grown daughter past cautious citizens with a heavy rope in his hand and declaring he would wear it out on his own daughter. My mother spread her door wide to the refugee, and then, instead of closing and locking it after her, she stood in it and stretched her arms across it, barring the way. The man swore, cursed, threatened her with his rope. My mother did not flinch or show any sign of fear. She stood straight and fine and lashed him, shamed him, derided him, defied him in tones not audible to the middle of the street, but audible to the man's conscience and dormant manhood. And he asked her pardon and gave her his rope and said with a most great and blasphemous oath that she was the bravest woman he had ever seen. And so he went his way without another word and troubled her no more. He and she were always good friends after that, for in her he had found a long-felt want, somebody who was not afraid of him. I remember one day in St. Louis, my mother walked out into the street and greatly surprised a burly cartman who was beating his horse over the head with the butt of his heavy whip. For she took the whip away from him and then made such a persuasive appeal on behalf of the ignorantly defending horse that he was tripped into saying he was to blame, and also into volunteering a promise, which of course he couldn't keep, for he was not built that way, a promise that he would never abuse a horse again. The day my mother did this, I stood trembling when she derided the huge man. But what I learned from this, and I never forgot, is that bullies are always cowards. And even in my 70th year, I've never seen an exception to that rule. It was one of the earliest lessons I learned from my mother. It's almost Mother's Day, and I'll stop now. I'll have more to say next time about my mother. Thank you.